I will call this meeting of the Subcommittee on Minnesota Water Policy to order. Want to thank all of you for being here. We do have a quorum present. We are expecting Senator Goggin and Representative Heitzman yet, and so, but we will get started at this point in time. And our first, typically Representative Fisher would be chairing this meeting, but he is tied up with his job today, and so his job in the real world, let's put it that way. I will conduct this meeting again. If you see your agenda there, item number one is approval of our subcommittee meeting minutes from August 20th. If you've had a chance to review them, is there a motion to approve said minutes?
So moved.
Move, is there a second?
Second.
It has been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is carried. We will then turn to item number two, and we're going to have a presentation of the water resources research at the University of Minnesota featuring Joel Larson. But before we begin that, are there any preliminary comments, Mr. Stark, that you have for us today?
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. Thanks for being here. We had a great field trip with the Clean Water Council folks yesterday. Many of you attended. I want to thank the council and Paul Gardner and the chairs for inviting us along. We were in southeastern Minnesota, out of the Rochester area. It was a good meeting on Sunday, and then a really nice field trip with a great day yesterday. So we'll talk about that, I think, a bit at the end of the meeting. But it was a very good event. So this morning we have two presentations. Those presentations deal with innovations in wastewater treatment and precision agriculture. Those are on the agenda because members of this committee asked to hear about these issues. So that's why we're here. Two great presentations by the University of Minnesota. And to introduce the speakers, I've asked Joel Larson to say a few words and to introduce them. Joel is the Associate Director at the Water Resources Center at the University. So much of this work is done in conjunction with the Water Resources Center. So with that, Mr. Chair, members, I'll turn this over to Mr. Larson.
Welcome, Mr. Larson, and please go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for having us here today. As Jim mentioned, I'm Joel Larson. I'm the Associate Director at the Water Resources Center at the University of Minnesota. Our director, Jeff Peterson, sends his regrets. He's not able to be here today, but from what I understand, he may have had some time with you all as part of the field tour over the last couple days.
We didn't realize we had been that hard on him on the tour. But,
No, it's the deans that get to be hard on him this morning.
Very good, yes.
So for those of you who might not be familiar, one of the roles of the Water Resources Center is to keep track of water-related research that's happening at the university. So that's part of what brings us here today, is to share what some of our researchers are working on. We also have an in-house research team that focuses primarily on the interaction between people and water, so how water impacts people and vice versa. Our other role is to make sure that the research that we do at the university gets out to the groups that need to use it. And that brings me to our purpose here today, to provide a background on innovative technologies for wastewater in small communities and innovations in precision agriculture. So I'll introduce the two speakers. Dr. Sarah Hager is a researcher within the Water Resources Center, focusing primarily on decentralized wastewater management. She's been at the center for actually 20 years this year, right there. And she has her BS in Biosystems and Agricultural Engineering and MS and PhD in Water Resources Science, all from the University of Minnesota. Sarah, unfortunately, has to leave for a flight partway through the meeting today, but she'll be able to finish her presentation during the first part here. So the second presenter is Dr. David Mulla. Dr. Mulla is a professor and the W.E. Larson Chair for Soil and Water Resources in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate. He focuses on research related to non-point source pollution of surface and groundwater, precision farming, alternative farm management strategies, and policies for soil and water resources. He received his BS in Earth Science from the University of California, Riverside, and MS and PhD in Agronomy from Purdue University. So at this point, I'll turn things over to Sarah for her presentation.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chairperson and committee members, I first just really want to thank you for this opportunity. When Joel told me you had requested to talk about this topic or learn a little bit more about it, I was really excited to have the opportunity. As my presentation is coming up here, over those 20 years, if you had told me that I would be here someday this passionate about wastewater, I would have laughed, right? So, but it is something that I spend every working day thinking about, and sometimes can't even ignore it while I'm on vacation, seeing a different wastewater system. So just a little bit about our program at the university. We've been around since the mid-70s doing training related to on-site wastewater systems. So primarily our focus has been on septic systems and soil-based wastewater treatment systems. But having an engineering background, and also when this topic came up, looking at the issue of communities up to 5,000, I also reached out to others within the university and at the MPCA so we could tell kind of the full story of what those issues are. So along with educating professionals, and really that program got started due to people recognizing that their lakes were turning green across Minnesota and that septic systems were part of the problem. But that problem, that our program really did grow after that. So you'll see in the 90s, we started doing education focused primarily on homeowners and small communities, which is really what I'm going to be focusing on today. So a lot of those small communities don't have easy answers. If they had an easy answer of just putting a septic system in their backyard or connecting to the wastewater treatment plant that's down the road, they would do that. But those options aren't available for them. The other opportunity we often have is to also conduct research and do demonstration projects across Minnesota that are answering needs of whether it be professionals or citizens. Our research program is very, very focused on applied solutions, which is what really these communities need. So I am first going to talk a little bit about the scale and size of the issue, then we'll talk about the primarily challenges that those small communities have, how are we currently addressing those issues, and finally, what can we do? And so the we is a collective we. It's we at the university, it's you all as the legislature, certainly regulatory and funders fit into this equation. So kind of first looking at the size and scale of the issue, it is an important distinction to understand that these communities are all not regulated the same way. So anything that surface discharges, so those are our large communities, have an MPCA permit. Then when we get into larger septic systems that are over 10,000 gallons a day, which is about 30 homes, those are also required to have an MPCA permit, and that's regardless if they surface discharge or whether they go into a soil-based treatment system. The final option is those smaller septic systems that are going to serve some of our small communities, right? So this could be 5, 10, 20, 30 homes. Those are all still regulated at a local level. There are increasing regulatory standards for those small communities. You can see at 2,500 and 5,000 gallons, our regulatory structure does recognize that there's increased risk, that one home going to a septic system isn't the same as 25 homes going to a septic system. So when the question was brought up under 5,000, I think it is really important to make a distinction between under 5,000. So, and the problems associated with some of those towns. So if we have a community with an existing wastewater treatment plant, it can often be that they aren't meeting their treatment goals. So that could be either that it was undersized for the population or it may have an outdated technology that's not performing. So generally speaking, these are larger in scale. They also, some of these smaller communities are going to have challenges in the future related to phosphorus, chloride, and nitrogen. And that's primarily because a lot of those small towns, when they put in a system in the 70s and 80s, they weren't designed to remove that level of contaminant to where our environmental standards have gone. And then we have what might actually be a larger issue, and that is we have a bunch of communities that actually don't have wastewater treatment. They don't even have the system that was put in the 70s and the 80s. So these are commonly referred to as unsewered communities. They're smaller in scale. They may be directly discharging untreated wastewater or have outdated septic systems. So looking a little bit more at that issue, the MPCA did do a survey of all 87 counties. They all reported their results, and they found over 1,200, almost 1,300 small communities that there's concern. So that concern could be we have no records about do they have a system? And when we say small community, the MPCA made the decision that anytime there were more than five homes within a half a mile, they were going to consider that a community. So that's very likely in that, you know, 1,282, right? Some of those may be aren't towns, right? It may be where the railroad crossing was, right? That a bunch of people happened to build a house there, 5-10 homes. And you'll see that over the last 2 years, they've been refining that list, so now we're down. But we're still above 1,000 small communities that we don't know that they have any wastewater treatment or certainly proper wastewater treatment. So among this list, certainly we need to prioritize effort. We cannot solve all 1,000-plus problems in the next couple years. So generally how that's done is looking at first for those imminent public health threats. Those are systems that are directly discharging wastewater to the surface. The other category is failing. So these are systems that could be negatively impacting groundwater. And that's not good, but at least you can't play in it, right? Your dogs can't be out in that wastewater. So these unsewered communities, there's also two types here. The first type are some areas are incorporated communities. So they are in a better place to obtain a community solution. So they have a town, they have a city council, right? They may, very few of them, but some of them may be able to certainly hire an engineer to help with their solution or have an engineer on staff. These communities have a much easier time at obtaining state funding because they already have the kind of structure in place to receive that funding. The other group is even more challenging, though. The unincorporated communities, they're not organized. Often the best solution for them is individual fixes, which then regulatory-wise, that can be challenged. It can be challenging to give those people grants and loans. It's easier at a county level, but at a state level, that gets to be challenging. And in general, there's very little grant money available. And it's not to say there isn't any, but it's all been targeted at very low income, and there's never enough. Every year when the agency looks to set that money aside, it's always there's never enough to help. So I can envision that these numbers aren't readable when they got printed, but kind of if you look at it in color in particular, anytime you see that the shading is, darker in that orange color, it's a higher number, right? So this indicates the number of communities reported by each of the counties that have an issue. So it is overall a statewide issue, but you do notice that there are some what I'll say are hot pocket areas.
Dr. Hager. I know at least one member is colorblind, and the numbers we can't quite discern, but could you just highlight those counties of highest concern and
perhaps? Yep, the highest colored counties on this map, so St. Louis County reported 196. You do have to know that some counties, though, I'm just going to put this caveat, have better records than others and have more information. So when I mentioned if there's no permit records from an area, that got identified as a community that we don't know about. So some other high ones you'll see, and if you kind of look at that whole Northeast region, it's shaded shades of orange, which are higher. Ottertail County reported 38, and then the kind of the other area that has high amounts is in that southeast area. So Winona, Houston, Rice County, Goodhue, Hennepin, Chisago, Isanti, Sherburn are all showing pretty high numbers.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
No, thank you. As long as we're stopped, I had a question regarding these identified areas of concern. How do they handle homes around lakes? Are those identified as communities also?
So yes, they are identified as communities. So because if you think about five homes within a half a mile, most of our lakes would fit into that category.
So thank Mr. Chair, given yes. That the number seems low, because I can think of you know, we have a lot of lakes, and a lot of them have homes around them, and many of them are not connected to a community sewer system.
Yeah, committee chair and members, I think the clearest answer is they were not identified by the county as having improper wastewater treatment. So many of our lakes, the first one that comes to mind is Otter Tail, because I know about a lot about Otter Tail. The septic systems around that lake are all compliant and good. So this is not the list of all communities that don't have sewer. This is the list of communities that do not have, that were identified by the county as not having adequate wastewater treatment.
Thank you.
Anyone else? If not, please proceed, Doctor.
So now kind of identifying the scale of the issue, we'll talk about some of the challenges. So first I'm looking at those larger communities. So these are often communities 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. So the first issue is chloride. So this is a map that was generated by the MPCA, which is wastewater treatment plants. So current wastewater treatment plants with a reasonable potential for having a chloride limit in the future. So you'll see there's 100 municipalities that are going to have a chloride limit in their permit. They don't, only 20 of them have one now. And there's not good technology to remove chloride. Really the best way to deal with chloride is taking it out on the front end. But that's challenging, right? How do you get everyone to stop having a water softener in their home? Which, well, we can get into that later. So the other thing that I wanted to think about, though, is so if you look at these 100 that I just showed, how many of those are small communities? Well, if you define it as under 5,000, 73 of that 100 are small communities. But you'll look, a lot of them, you'll see almost 30 of them are under 1,000 in population. Then the next one, again, I think that's about 21 or 22, are also in that low population. So these are small communities that in the future are very likely to have a chloride limit. The next one is nitrogen issues. So there are approximately 300 pond systems in operation. 23% of these ponds are not effective in their nitrogen removal. And when we talk about nitrogen, our wastewater treatment plants are not designed to remove all the nitrogen. What they're really designed is to take the ammonia, which is toxic to fish, and convert it to nitrate. So this isn't saying that they're removing all of the nitrogen, but what it's saying is they're also not adequately always dealing with that ammonia, which can cause fish kills. The other challenge that is upcoming for a lot of wastewater treatment plants is phosphorus. So going back to that definition of 5,000, there's approximately 5,000 small wastewater treatment plants in Minnesota. 225 of them currently have a phosphorus limit. Approximately 100 will get a limit upon their next permit renewal in the next 5 years. So an upgrading for phosphorus treatment can be a significant addition to an existing plant. It usually doesn't require a redesign of the wastewater treatment plant, but it requires an additional step. So I think the last issue that I wanted to address that applies to all of these communities that's a challenge is their affordability. So again, this was actually another chart that an engineer at the MPCA had put together that looks at the cost. And it really was interesting to me. So living in Minneapolis myself, I'm hooked up to Met Council's wastewater treatment plant. And the line across the bottom, if you can't distinguish those, is the Met Council service area. So which generally speaking, if you're hooked to Met Council, you're going to be paying the cheapest wastewater rates because of the population base primarily. But then kind of as you go up, and what you'll notice across the top is the smaller communities are paying the highest wastewater costs. And this is average data, right? You can take any individual wastewater treatment plan and it may not fit exactly. I mean, there are some small communities paying very affordable rates. But when you look at if they're upgrading and have current technology, the costs are much higher in small communities. And sometimes the population, particularly the economic local economics don't support those higher costs.
Yes, Senator Eaton.
Thank you. My question is, did you develop any kind of estimate of the 1,000 plus unsewered communities, what the cost would be to rectify that?
Senator Eaton and committee members, I asked the MPCA for that specific, because they've really spent a lot of time looking at that list of 1,200 communities, and they were unable to provide an estimate. I think it could be done. The biggest challenge is the size of those communities is so broad. I mean, going from five homes to on that unsewered list, I would say most of those communities are topping out in the 500 range. We're not talking about communities of 5,000 that are unsewered. So I think that estimate could be done, but it's certainly a lot of money. So what are we currently doing about this issue at the university? We just completed an LCCMR project looking at the chloride issue in particular. And in this 20 plus minutes that I get to talk, I can only hit the highlights. And so one of the highlights I pulled from that was an assessment looking at the contribution of water softening to wastewater treatment plants. And what you'll see if you add up both the residential and commercial softening, 65% of a typical wastewater treatment plant's chloride input is from water softening. So we need to deal with, for many of these communities, that means people in the end, some of them may not be able to have softeners in their home. Can we optimize softeners? But we really need to look more closely at this softener issue. The second one was a project we were involved with, a national project that was predicting the cost of community scale wastewater. So this project actually developed software that could be used in small communities. It's a spreadsheet-based economic model. It also contains fact sheets that are geared towards community members, not towards engineers, to help them understand their options. This tool provides users with fundamental information about the operation of various wastewater management options and cost estimates that are tied to local cost indices. Another project actually occurring, this work is being done in the civil engineering department by Paige Novak. It's another LCCMR funded research. This project is relatively new. They are looking at to understand why ponds are underperforming, particularly related to that nitrogen map I showed previously. How can we improve that? Understand how nitrogen is removed in these systems and develop simple methods to improve the nitrogen removal for some of those existing pond systems that are out there. Looking back in our history within the Water Resource Center, the on-site sewage treatment program has worked with over 20 Minnesota small communities. That work that we have done has focused on education and facilitation. So that includes first convincing some of these towns that they have a problem. And you wouldn't think that that needs to be done, but sometimes they've had a system, their toilets have flushed, they don't actually recognize there's a problem. So that gets into the wastewater treatment basics. How are they going to go about making decisions? How do they go about hiring professionals to work with their community? What are their options? And finally, these systems go in and they need to be managed, and that's really important. As those towns get smaller, then again, they don't have an operator on staff. Right, so they need to understand that there's both an operator involved and a cost associated with operating that system over the life of it. So, not going to get into the details, but this is just to show you across Minnesota, we've been working with small communities. Lately, that's just been done on an on-demand basis. We did have some staff going back, 10-ish years that were very active on this, but currently there just hasn't been a funding source to support kind of the higher level involvement that you see on this slide. So the final topic is what is needed for these small communities. And in the end, it's for these small communities, but it's for the water in Minnesota, right? So if they don't have proper wastewater treatment, they're negatively impacting either our surface or groundwater. So MnDrive has actually identified this as an issue that we need to be listening better to what our small water and wastewater systems have. So the MnDrive program is focused, I would say, on those small wastewater treatment plant communities, probably in the 1 to 5,000 range of what we've been talking about today. So just trying to identify what are their challenges, what could they use. So there will be a report that actually comes out of the water one already happened, but the wastewater one hasn't happened to date. So looking at that economic issue, what needs to be continued applied is a hierarchy. So looking at starting on the left, these communities need a good process in place to come up with the most economical solution. So looking at the cost of these systems, you can see that if I can put a system in my backyard, it is always going to be the least cost, When you start looking at community solutions, the cost goes up. So you can potentially still get a tank and a gravity drain field in Minnesota, and I pick the number 8,000. It depends a little where you live and your size of your home and all of that. When we start looking at small community solutions that are soil-based, you're looking at 30,000 plus. And so that hierarchy is that what I stated, is there an option on your property to treat your wastewater? If there's not, is there a place nearby where you can put a septic system in with your neighbors? Can that get state funding, local funding? Are there options out there for grants and loans? And really then the last one is, can they regionalize? So where is the closest wastewater treatment plant? And I didn't even put the fourth one on, because to me the fourth one is almost completely unfeasible, which is building a new wastewater treatment plant. The cost of that is exorbitant, right? So it should be on the list, right? Because it is for some communities might be the option. But so this is not a new hierarchy. This is a hierarchy that's been around. But the question is also, how do we validate that this has been well, that this process has actually been gone through, as opposed to just going to the end, right? Which is, we'll connect to the closest town that's 2 miles away. Well, 2 miles of sewer, right? That's expensive. So there's also technical issues that I've highlighted today that we need more research on, reduction of nitrogen, phosphorus, and chloride. You'll see I don't have basic wastewater. I mean, we've been treating wastewater long enough that when it comes to dealing with those primary issues, we've always dealt with the organic load, the bacteria, and the viruses. We've well figured that out. But there still can be additional work and research done, particularly looking at those three kind of, and to me, they're not newer contaminants, but they're newer from when we first started treating wastewater. I also think we're going to have to think as a state about more technical options and even potentially regulatory changes needed to state permitting. Right now, if you apply for a state permit to surface discharge to a lake, river, stream, it actually doesn't matter if you're a town of 100 or you're a town of 100,000. And that's not quite fair, right? It depends. I mean, certainly there's some dilution in the stream and things that go in, but overall, the cost of that state permit, there's a lot of things that, for those small towns, when you talk about 20 homes, they are never going to get a surface discharge permit. They can't afford it up front. They can't afford the long-term reporting requirements. And the scale of that town is different, right? 20 homes surface discharging is different than 100,000 homes. So there could be some potential changes there. These small communities also need assistance. Generally speaking, they don't have staff, and often they have no planning funds. There is some exception through a PFA program where they can get some small upfront planning money to help, but I think we need more resources there. We need more funding mechanisms, particularly targeted at those unincorporated communities. But I don't think this issue is just solved with money, because it gets back to the fact of, how are they actually going to get those loans? Who's going to administer them? How are they going to make a decision? Because often they can have more than one option that could meet the regulatory requirements. So that requires facilitation. So that's something as simple as someone who's going to schedule the meetings, who's going to take notes. We're not talking about, you know, a community that has a recorder. Second is they need advocacy. So they are going to be applying for loans. They are going to be hiring an engineer. And the question is, who's going to help these communities through that process? Along with that is technical support, and that advocacy and technical support sometimes overlap and sometimes they don't. And the last one is management considerations. So sometimes these communities get a brand new system and they didn't fully understand the cost and the level of management that was going to take over the life of the system. So kind of in closing, just recently the largest septic system in Minnesota was permitted. It's not the largest by any means in the U.S., but it's for downtown Afton. So this doesn't necessarily serve all of when you think of Afton, but downtown Afton at 77 residential connections, 25 commercial systems. They have conventional gravity collection. So you can see their design flow was 50,000 gallons a day. And that is all discharging into the soil. And it's at the end of the day, if you looked at the schematics for the plant, it looks like a small wastewater treatment plant. That's what we're building, right? That's actually what a septic system is. It just happens to be in your backyard. So the scale of soil-based systems can be quite large. I mean, this system has nitrogen removal. It's advanced. It's protecting groundwater and surface water. So there are solutions out there, but the question generally gets to be, is it affordable? Right, so what are the sewer rates? What, and often what can be challenging is some of these small towns previously, what they were paying for sewer and water versus when they get a system, it's a significant increase for them. And I don't know the economics of Afton, but I can guess that the economics of Afton are different than some of our other communities across Minnesota when it comes to income levels. But that doesn't mean for some of those people in that town that wasn't a challenge. When they went from not having a sewer bill to having a sewer bill. So with that, if you all have questions and discussion, I'm happy to.
Dr. Hager, I'd like to comment. For the last couple of years, I've been visiting with folks over in the bioproducts, biosystems, and CFANs, and I guess what. What communications does your department have with them? And basically what I've been doing is I've been pushing for an expanded research into a biosystem type of treatment because, quite frankly, your reference into various spots about the inaffordability of what we're doing now is right on. We insist on multi-million dollar plants that produce such a minute improvement that they actually make no sense whatsoever in terms of their efficiency and the use of appropriate resources, and particularly when we hear what the billions of dollars of potential costs that we have out there, we actually need to be able to spend money in a way that produces the maximum result. So what communication have you had with CFANs and particularly with the bioproducts division, biosystems division, in regards to that kind of research and furthering that?
Senator Weber and committee members, my undergraduate is in biosystems and ag engineering. I still haven't gotten the bioproducts. It doesn't roll off the tongue for me. But that being said, so we do interact. We had a project a couple years ago with Professor Bohu in that department looking at potential innovations to the septic tank in particular. So we do have regular interaction with that. Particularly Professor Bohu is an expert in anaerobic digestion, that's where his kind of focus has been, but that's been the primary work. From my perspective, having worked on wastewater for 20 years at the university, they've had very little work in the human wastewater world. Their real focus has been more towards animal agriculture than it has been toward and animal waste than it has been to human waste. So I also know there's been some work done with algae in that department as well in wastewater treatment. I think you have to go back with that work and think about affordability for small communities. And I have yet to see some affordable new options, but we have to keep trying. We have to keep looking at the issue. But it is really hard to improve general wastewater treatment, meaning it's kind of a, you know, there's only so many ways to do it. But I do think on the nitrogen and phosphorus end is where we have potential to increase and to potentially increase the technology options and potentially decrease some of the costs we're seeing.
Thank you.
I also think we need to look at more soil-based treatment systems anytime we can. The soil is an amazing treatment mechanism. If there's anything I learned going through that ag engineering program, that's what I learned, is if you can use a passive system versus a mechanical system that has, right, carbon inputs, the energy inputs to some of those higher mechanical plants are huge when the soil. But so the soil can work, but when you start talking about 10,000 people, you need a pretty big area of soil. And so if you're really outstate Minnesota, that can be an option. But if you start looking at some of our small communities that are in denser areas, that can get to be a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Senator Dreheim, did you have?
You had the same thought.
Oh, okay. Very good. Senator Goggin.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to echo what Senator Weber said, because my hometown of Red Wing is very nervous about these new levels. And as the senator said, there's so infinitesimal difference in what we're proposed to get with these new levels. It's going to cost, just off the cuff, initially $50 million for my hometown of 16,500 people to have to build a new wastewater treatment center, because they, talking with the city folks and the city engineer and that, they said we can't economically retrofit our existing plant. So now they're going to be stuck with trying to figure out how they're going to implement this, because it's required by law then. And so those are things we have to really consider, as the senator said. Are we getting really true gains out of this for the small, for the large cost that we're going to have to pay for it? And I can tell you, my town right now just put an initial proposed levy of 15.59%, with about a 6.38% property tax increase on every home. And I'll tell you what, I keep hearing more and more from residents, we're being taxed right out of our homes and out of our away from our friends and family. So we need to take all of that into consideration.
Representative Parkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Hager. This is a very interesting presentation, highlights many of the things we've been talking about for some time. You didn't talk at all about trading. Have you looked at that at all? And, there's various ways to do trading, but it's a way to, it's one way to delay investment until technology catches up to an affordable level. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Representative Torkelson and the committee members, I personally haven't looked at trading. Trading is certainly an issue that has had both some attention here in Minnesota and nationally. So I think that those options are should be on the table, particularly, and where I hear them brought up most isn't with relation to TMDLs. When we have a TMDL and it's easier to get a gain in one location versus another, I think that there is certainly, and that is what you're referring to, right, when we talk about trading. There certainly is, because at the end of the day, the environment, right, the water, doesn't care where the reduction in phosphorus came from, right? So I do think that that's something that needs to be considered. The question will be, the only concern I sometimes have is, how long are we going to wait for technology? Because I do know on the chloride issue, the MPCA will be issuing variances to their rule, because there isn't cost-effective, reasonable technology that can be installed today. So, and I hope someday, for instance, we can easily on a home level remove hardness without salt. That's my dream, right? Is that going to happen? I don't know, because if I had the idea, I could retire, right? So that is the only concern when I have people say, when there's a bit, and things are always changing, right? We are always innovating. So, but I do think for some of these communities, it might be very likely might be the solution they need to enact. And I think in some areas we may need to also look at things like variances when we technically, because like the chloride issue, the only solution that some of these communities have is to centrally soften. Very expensive. Mm-hmm. Cost prohibitive. Can't do it. So it's not actually a wastewater issue, it's a water issue. Mm-hmm. So I think there are instances where we're going to have to go down some different paths.
Representative Torkelson?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up to that. A little different question, though. I know that an individual ground-based septic systems, they are sized based basically on the number of bedrooms in the home. How does that scale up? You talked about this system in Afton. Do they, when they size that system, do they kind of bring that average down? Because it would be prohibitively expensive to treat for every bedroom in a community of that size.
Yeah, Senator Torkelson and committee members, that's a really interesting point. In general, our regulatory structure does allow, because again, when you think about why we design on bedrooms, it's maximum occupancy, right? But when you start to get communities together, you can start to look at what are the actual typical averages across a community. So that some of those engineering principles are applied, but we always build in safety factor. So interestingly, when I reached out to the engineering firm who designed Afton, I told you the design flow was right around 50,000. Their average flows have been 10,000. So we may need to look at safety factor a little closer, but I will highlight, I was also at a community about 10 years ago that they designed on the number of people in the community and used 60 gallons. And every time that town had their annual festival, the system didn't work. So you have to be a little careful. Like, so AFTA need to be designed at 50? Maybe not, right? But should it have been designed at 15? Probably not. So, but I do think we need to think about flows, and that once you get into larger communities, we need to look at what those real peaks are and design for those peaks, because we do want these systems to last a long time. So that's the other reason why septic systems, I think, are generally on the large size for most people, is to build in that 20, 30, 40 year life expectancy. But very good point.
Representative Torkelson, congratulations on your elevation.
Perhaps we should have a requirement for more porta potties on festival day.
Well, that was their solution, I believe.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to mention that in the city of St. Peter, one of the cities that I represent, we pay an extra $10 per month for the bonding to pay for an RO plant. And it is more than just a wastewater issue. It is also a water issue. And then the last thing I just wanted to mention real quick is we talked a lot about the different chemicals, but what about the pharmaceuticals? Is there any conventional wisdom or any conversations that are being had about small cities or large cities, for that matter, addressing the pharmaceuticals that are making their way into our water bodies across the state?
Representative Brand and committee members. The issue is yes, and I actually didn't put that in this talk because to me it's kind of an issue over here right now. So we currently have a project where we're looking at chemicals of emerging concern and what's in the wastewater, what's in the soil, because if you're applying this either with a septic system or a lot of our biosolids in Minnesota are applied to fields, what's happening in the soil, and finally what's going on with groundwater. So I think the short answer is some of them are being removed and some of them aren't. I mean, we can get into any individual pharmaceutical, and the issue is, of course, too, is now you're talking about a whole nother suite of contaminants of concern that someday we might need to look at. The issue is with most of these at the levels, we don't have a health risk limit, right? We don't know at what levels it's safe to consume. But there is work being both done in our department and also in civil engineering. Tim LaPara does a lot of that work looking at chemicals of emerging concern in wastewater. So I think it's something we're gonna continue both here in Minnesota and nationally to gain more information about. But what I will tell you is, and again, I'm a little biased because I'm a soil-based wastewater treatment person, is the soil has such a range of microorganisms that if you compare just typical aeration activated sludge to the soil, you get better removal. And the thought, because we still haven't well understood the mechanisms, is that the diverse microbiology that's occurring in the soil is you can't make that, right? You can't. It's like baby formula, right? It's not the same. So it's the same kind of idea, is that the soil, particularly looking at the fungi in the soil, are a critical part. So I do know that people are looking, though, at more ways to mimic nature, right? I mean, wastewater is nature, right? When we treat wastewater, we're using natural bacteria, but could we try to more mimic that? Building in carbon sources into the soil and things along those lines. So there is certainly work going on in that arena.
Senator Wieger.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Heger, I appreciate the reference earlier to the Metropolitan Council. I recognize that the focus on small communities, but the council was formed in 1967 because of this issue, and thanks to Governor Lavander, it became reality. And I served on the Met Council in the 80s, and in the in-service, it was when in terms of what we do, they basically boiled it down to, when you flush, think of us, and then the whole metropolitan urban service area. So they're making great progress, but the challenge for small communities, we've got to come up with a cost-effective way, reference to variances, et cetera, is going to be a part of it. On the point of what you're doing, could you also talk about, just internationally? I mean, this is a huge challenge for the planet. So are you talking with other universities, academia throughout the world, and maybe I'm assuming you are, but maybe just a bit on that subject, and an exemplary part of the planet, perhaps it's in Europe, that we might learn from.
So, Senator Wieger and committee members, I want to go back to your Met Council comment. It is certainly, and Met Council doesn't stop, right? They're looking at water reuse as well. So they're going to continue to, I think, help here within the 7 or 10 county metro area, depending upon how you define that. Looking at this internationally, I would say there's kind of two areas that are leading. Certainly Europe, I always think it's because they are around longer than us and they're denser than us, that they are often innovating. They're actually using, it's gotten, like Germany, for instance, uses a lot of membranes. Membranes are relatively, so we talk about RO. RO is a membrane, but using membranes for wastewater treatment. The problem is they're not inexpensive and they have a high level of management. So there are now residential scale membrane systems out on the market. They can produce, and I never say drinking water quality because of chemicals of emerging concern, but water that is very clean. So that technology is also being used in some very dense parts of Asia, so Japan. There's some more reuse systems. So looking at, can we actually reuse within the facility? So some of that work even going on in California and Arizona. So areas that are much more arid than us are certainly looking at more at getting the water clean enough that we're not going to be discharging it. We're going to be using it again. So to me, internationally, that is the biggest kind of driver of issues is water scarcity. Which isn't necessarily our issue here, particularly this summer. But in general, people, if you think about, I was just at Vermilion State Park, so one of our newest state parks, and they are taking shower water and using it to flush toilets, treating it in between, right? We have an example of that on the U of M campus. But actually building something in the middle of the city that does that, not necessarily, we think about, you know, on the landscape we can reuse, but actually reusing within structures. That's something that our state has talked a lot about. It's not easy to do those projects in Minnesota right now. You actually need a variance from the plumbing code. So I think there will be, that's kind of an, I would say, an emerging issue and something we'll continue to talk about in Minnesota to develop policies and regulations around some of those issues.
Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Doctor. I appreciate the comments you'd made about, you know, the small towns, small communities, and the challenges they face because of their small size and just meeting the costs of permitting requirements and things of that nature. And I would like to reiterate, I guess they need to really focus on those issues as well, and to try to look at maybe having a not a one-size-fits-all kind of model, but a model that recognizes those unique challenges that are faced in small communities. I have recently a small town of Borup in our area, which is looking at extremely expensive costs for upgrading their wastewater treatment, and it's a community of about 100 people, and the costs are so prohibitively expensive that, I mean, it threatens their very existence, the very, you know, ability of them to survive and to continue to exist. And I also wonder about, as far as, you know, the help, you mentioned that too, that they don't have any staff, you know, to be working on these things and following all these complicated issues. And what about the issue of the standards themselves? Whether there should be different standards applied to communities based on their ability to, to comply with the current standards. Senator Goggin had been talking about, some of the extremely high expenses and the very small benefits that you get, and you were mentioning that as well, Senator Weber. So I think we need to look at that generally. But do you think there'd be justification for having kind of a, again, not a one-size-fits-all model, but different models and different standards based on the community's size and their resources? Just your thoughts on that.
Senator Eakin and committee members, I do want to state that there are, and again, I am not a wastewater treatment plant standard expert. Someone at the agency could tell you all that. But that being said, I know in the soil-based treatment world, there are increasing standards as your systems get larger. When we look at wastewater treatment plants, the receiving environment of that stream does matter. So the best example I know of is, I was told that the wastewater treatment plant in downtown St. Paul will never have a chloride limit because it's going into the Mississippi River. There's so much dilution that meeting the standard of 230, it's going to happen, right? Because it's such a large stream. So there are specific examples that I can think of where there is a varying standard based on the flow coming from the community and the receiving environment. Right? A pristine trout stream receiving wastewater effluent is different. That being said, I still think there could be room for further discussion about what you were just talking with our current regulatory structure. And should there be more flexibility for towns that where you have 3,000 people versus, right, 30,000 people, and then you can go up from there, right, or down. And how should that regulatory structure best deal with the pollutant load that's coming from those different communities? Because it's different. And you can't take the phosphorus out of the wastewater, right? We all excrete phosphorus. There's no way to eliminate it. It's not like chloride where we could look to cut back. We're always going to be putting phosphorus in our wastewater, same with nitrogen. So it's so I think those are things to think about. And the thing about wastewater treatment plants, big to small, is they're easy to regulate because they're a pipe, right? So there's also the issue of other non-point source pollution, which others might talk about after me, and how can we look at other inputs to our lakes, rivers, and streams that may be having a larger impact.
Well, if there are no other questions from the committee members, Dr. Hager, thank you for your presentation. I'm sure there's probably other things that people would like to talk about, but we recognize that you need to get going as well. So,
thank you. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you. Okay, at this point, we're going to turn to the presentation on precision agriculture with Dr. Mulla.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and members. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm going to talk about the non-point source pollution today, which is by far and away the biggest source of pollution that we have in our rivers, lakes, and groundwater, especially for nitrogen. And my talk is going to focus on precision agriculture. I'm the director of the Precision Agriculture Center at the University of Minnesota, and we have a lot of exciting things going on. So how many of you know what precision agriculture is? A lot of you. Okay, so I don't have to define it. We get a lot of information from yield monitors, soil databases, remote sensing, soil sampling, combine those together, and we can make recommendations to farmers to better manage fertilizer. So we can put the fertilizer on at the right rate, at the right time, in the right location. We can also do that with irrigation, with water, or with pesticides. So it has a wide scope. And the benefits of precision agriculture include increased profitability for the farmers. And this comes about through two things. One is the increased efficiency of the output of the inputs. So you're using the fertilizer, the pesticides, the water, putting them where they're needed, in the amount they're needed. And it also comes about through increased yield and quality of the crop. And all of this leads to better environmental outcomes. So you get less leaching of nitrate and less runoff as well. And this diagram here just shows a map of how we might apply variable rates of nitrogen in a field. And this is a big improvement over applying one single rate at one single time, which is not very efficient. So conventional agriculture is typically done using uniform management. And this ignores the variability in the field, whether it's the variability in the crop yield, the variability in the soil, or the variability in the landscape. And as a result, we can decrease the use of farm inputs by putting them where they're needed when they're needed. The U of M is a worldwide leader in precision agriculture. The concept of precision agriculture originated here at the University of Minnesota in the early 1980s. And the university founded the International Conference on Precision Agriculture in 1992, which brings together about 500 experts from around the world, from 35 countries. And we're hosting that again this next year. It's going to be in July. We established the first Precision Agriculture Center in the world in 1995. And we founded the premier journal where scientists publish precision agriculture research in the year 2000. And I've had a role in every single one of these four accomplishments. So I was one of the first three people in the world to develop the concept of precision agriculture. I was involved in presenting my ideas at the first conference. I was the associate director of the Precision Ag Center in 1995, and I'm an associate editor for the Precision Agriculture Journal. So our precision agriculture research is multidisciplinary, and this is what drives innovation. We have research involving 20 faculty members from the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Science, six different departments, and from the College of Science and Engineering, that's two different departments. And we do a lot of our research at the research and outreach centers located throughout the state, Waseca, Lamberton, and Crookston. NSF, the USDA, and Minnesota agencies in the legislature have provided major funding for this precision agriculture research through things like MinDrive and AGREET, which enabled you to hire new faculty in precision agriculture. And we also have established several centers of excellence in, for instance, robotics, sensors, and manufacturing. And we have a strong history of international collaboration all over the world. Some of the examples of how farmers are innovating through precision agriculture would include things like auto steer on the tractors, yield mapping, variable rate, fertilizer, irrigation, herbicide, and seeding, and grid or management soil zone soil sampling. And the figure here on the right shows how companies have adapted to providing services to farmers. So, for example, back in 1997, only 20% of the farm co-ops and the technical service providers provided farmers with technical advice about variable rate fertilizer. Today, that number is about 70%. And, you know, you can look at things like seeding. Variable rate seeding has jumped up in terms of a service that's provided. Now, this isn't necessarily the rate of adoption by farmers. These graphs aren't showing that. They're just showing the growth in business and companies that provide services to farmers. However, the actual adoption rates by farmers of different types of precision agriculture vary from about 20% to about 90%, with the highest adoption rate being for auto steer, which happened in 2001, way before cars became auto driving. So again, the innovation in agriculture drives innovation in many other fields, including transportation. All the auto steer technology you're seeing in automobiles originated with tractors on the farm. So precision agriculture is very high tech, and the farmers of today are smart, they're technologically aware, and they're using a lot of cutting edge tools like global positioning satellites, geographic information systems to map the variability, yield monitors to measure the variability and yield, computer models, remote sensing with satellites, airplanes, and drones, proximal sensors mounted on tractors that can sense nitrogen or soil properties. We're making use of the LIDAR data that was invested in by Minnesota to make better decisions based on topography. We're using machine learning, deep learning, artificial intelligence, and big data because we collect a lot of data through precision agriculture. And we're developing specialized farm equipment to do the variable rate spreading, drones, and robots.
Dr. Mulla, I was just curious. I know that in the initial rollout of some of these technologies, obviously the upfront capital improvement costs for farmers was substantial in terms of equipping their equipment in order to be able to do this. Obviously, so it kept, I think, the initial action activity confined to some of the larger operators. Are we seeing a respectable decrease in those kind of costs that allows more and more operators to take advantage of it at this point?
Honorable Chair and members, yes, that's a very good question. And the costs today are quite a bit lower than they were initially. For example, many of the service providers that work with farmers can provide remote sensing imagery for as little as 25 cents an acre. It's almost free. And other things cost more. Obviously, if you're going to buy auto steer and you want the best possible auto steer, that's going to cost you about $15,000, you know, for the tractor. So the costs are certainly much more affordable now than they were in the past, and this is driving increased adoption. So I'm going to talk to you about maybe three major examples of how our research is making a difference, and then how we're working with industry and with extension and outreach to provide better information to agribusiness and growers. So we'll talk about variable rate nitrogen for surface water quality, soybean aphid detection for reduced use of herbicides and pesticides, and nitrogen and irrigation management for groundwater protection. So nitrate contamination of our surface waters is a pressing concern. We have high nutrient losses in southern Minnesota due to high fertilizer and manure application rates on corn, as well as mineralization of large amounts of nitrogen from soil organic matter. Our average soil organic matter content in Minnesota is 6%. This is a lot of nitrogen that's available in the soil, and that helps to grow a healthy crop. We have heavy precipitation, especially in the last 20, 25 years. It causes more leaching and loss of nitrates through our subsurface drain tiles. And Minnesota has set long-term goals to reduce the nitrogen loads in Minnesota by 45%, with an interim target of 20% by 2025. So keep those numbers in mind. These are sort of the targets that are set. So variable rate nitrogen is a concept that involves matching the rate of fertilizer to the crop growth and uptake patterns. And the idea is to apply a small amount of fertilizer before the crop is planted, and then to go in the month of June after you use remote sensing of the crop to find out where you need more nitrogen, to apply a side dress application. And with this approach, we can reduce the amount of fertilizer applied. We get away from uniform application. If farmers are applying fall uniform rates of fertilizer, this helps reduce those overwinter and early spring losses. And it ends up being good for the crop and reducing the losses of nitrogen to our waters. So we have a research project that's been going on for 3 years now at Waseca, funded by the Minnesota Department of Ag through the Clean Water Research Fund, to use remote sensing from drones to determine how to make a recommendation for this variable rate nitrogen. And we're measuring the crop yield and the nitrogen leaching to see how much it benefits the farmers and the environment.
Dr. Mulla, I know, and I agree with what you just stated. I also know that this summer, for example, the idea of a mid-season side dress was challenging, to say the least, in many of our areas. Is there progress being made in terms of thinking of dry fertilizer, for example, with nitrogen, the treatment of the fertilizer itself to allow for more of a slow release extension, even if they wanted to put on that planting time, but would delay the release to further into the season?
Honorable Chair and members, yes, there is a slow release fertilizer available for nitrogen. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later.
Okay. Good enough.
And that's another option when you have these kinds of challenging conditions. And in our research this year, we also faced the same kind of challenges. We ended up putting most of our nitrogen on towards the end of June, which is not what we really, really want to do. And many farmers were unable to plant this year, especially southwestern Minnesota, because of the challenging conditions. So it's a very challenging year. So there are there are certain years where, you know, these types of approaches are more challenging. All right, so here's an example of what we might do. Apply different rates of fertilizer to corn, and, you know, the areas that have the high rates of fertilizer look green and healthy. The areas with lower rates are yellowish, and that's a typical sign of nitrogen deficiency. So with our unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, we can take photographs of the crop, and we can identify where more nitrogen is needed. Then we have another technology which involves small robots. That's a little yellow guy here on the right, which goes through the rows of the corn during the later parts of the season. And this is another way for getting around the problem of having, you know, late application of nitrogen. With this small robot, you can actually apply nitrogen all the way into July without damaging the crop. And estimates by Deed have shown that these two technologies, plus the accompanying artificial intelligence and associated technical services, could lead to 1,000 new jobs in Minnesota and nearly $150 million being pumped into the economy. And we're seeing this happen already with many companies that are taking advantage of these technologies here in Minnesota. So what we do is we take remote sensing images to look at the reflectance from the crop. The crop has chlorophyll molecules that are responsible for photosynthesis, and those chlorophyll molecules absorb in the blue and the red wavelengths, and they don't absorb very much in the green wavelengths, which makes the crops look green. So by looking at the reflectance, we can tell whether the photosynthesis and the chlorophyll content is going down because of lack of nitrogen, or whether there's plenty of nitrogen and you don't need to fertilize. And then what we do is we take ratios of the reflectance. We calculate something like a normalized difference vegetative index, and we look at how that responds to different rates of fertilizer. And we know what the optimum rate is for a given field in a given year. And then for any other spot in the field, based on the NDVI value, we can tell how much more nitrogen needs to be added. And it ends up allowing us to make these recommendations that vary across the field so that we can apply the right rate at the right time at the right location. So we do that by placing a map in the fertilizer spreader. The GPS on the fertilizer spreader knows where the fertilizer spreader is relative to the map, and then we can vary the rate of nitrogen that's applied. So in our research at Waseca, we applied about 20 to 30% less nitrogen in the variable rate experiments than in the uniform areas, which received the farmers' typical application rates, and there was no significant decrease in the crop yields. We had very good crop yields with both of the treatments. The uniform is the one in white, and the green is the variable rate. We're at about 200 bushels, which is a healthy yield. Now, some people might say, what if we just don't apply any nitrogen? Wouldn't we have better water quality? Well, the answer is, yeah, you'd probably have better water quality, but look at the corn yield. Corn yield is just pathetic. So we still need to feed people and animals, and we can't do that if we don't apply nitrogen fertilizer. So we need to apply nitrogen fertilizer just in a smarter way, and that's what we're doing. So here's a graph that is based on research at Waseca, Lamberton, and Wilmer over about 10 to 15 years. And what this shows is on the y-axis how much we're able to what the amount of nitrate loss is through the tile drainage. So it goes from zero to about somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 pounds per acre. And on the x-axis is the precipitation. So precipitation really drives the losses of nitrogen to the environment. And then what we've done here is we've taken all our research results and looked at the differences in nitrate losses as a function of the rate that's applied, anywhere from 180 in the fall to a variable rate treatment, which is the yellow at the bottom, which involves much lower rates applied split during the spring and the early summer. And in a normal year, if you compare the highest rate in the fall to the variable rate, we can get a 30% reduction in our nitrate losses. In a wet year, we can get a 45% reduction. So again, think back to the goals that has been set in the state. The goals are, in the long term, to reach a 45% reduction in nitrogen losses, and in the interim, by 2025, a 20%. So this technology that we're researching right now has the potential to be a real game changer. And we are hoping that, you know, we can increase the adoption of this practice among farmers. The second topic I want to talk about is soybean aphid detection using remote sensing. Soybean aphids are a major pest for soybean crops, and they can produce yield losses of up to 40%. Right now, scouts try to detect where aphid infestations are heavy by walking through fields and observing about 20 to 40 plants. If there's more than 250 aphids on a plant, it needs to be sprayed, otherwise you'll get a big crop loss. Now, walking through a field and only, you know, sampling 20 to 40 plants is not very accurate, because we have, in a typical acre, we might have 133,000 plants. Think about how many we have on a whole farm. It's just not very efficient. With remote sensing, we can see every plant. So we can identify where the infestations are and how severe they are. This doesn't show up too well, but with remote sensing, we can actually detect the areas that have soybeans and differentiate those from the areas that don't. So the areas that don't have soybeans have a high reflectance because the crop is healthy, and areas that have a high infestation of aphids have lower reflectance because they're being damaged by the crop. So what we do then is we use artificial intelligence with this large amount of data to identify all the plants that have more than 250 aphids, and those we have to spray. On the other hand, we don't have to spray the other plants that are below the threshold. And so this allows us to really be more precise in using our insecticides, spraying them where they're needed, when they're needed, before the widespread damage occurs. So this is an immense breakthrough. And we've applied for patents on this as well as the previous technology. The third topic I want to talk about is groundwater contamination with nitrates. This map shows locations that have high nitrate contamination. It's mostly the central sands of Minnesota and southeastern Minnesota, where we have karst topography. And so let's talk about the central sands, where we have a lot of irrigated agriculture that's used to grow corn and potatoes. Nitrate leaching is a big concern, and we're doing research to identify management practices that can minimize this problem. We're looking at a wide range of practices, like the timing of nitrogen application, splitting it, or fertigating, using different forms, which gets to a previous question, anhydrous versus urea versus a slow release. We're looking at better water management, such as irrigation scheduling or variable rate irrigation. And we're looking at vegetative practices that involve cover crops, perennial crops, and crop rotations that involve more perennials in them. So we have a research facility at Westport, Minnesota. Fabian Fernandez and his group have been running this project for a number of years, and I'm also involved along with a couple other colleagues to look at modeling the results from the site. And we're looking at a corn-soybean and soybean-corn rotation with a large range in nitrogen application rates that are applied through the irrigation system. We're looking at improved irrigation scheduling through remote sensing and through better crop modeling. And we've planted a rye cover crop to see how much of an impact that would make on the leaching losses. So with regards to the effect of the different rates of fertilizer and the different forms, so we have a range from no fertilizer all the way up to 270 kilograms per hectare. And then we have some slow release fertilizers as well. If we reduce the nitrogen rate from 270 down to 180, and we use a slow release fertilizer, we can reduce the nitrogen losses by about 20%, which is, again, a very significant reduction. If we use improved irrigation practices so that we actually irrigate when the crop needs it, when the soil is depleted of water, we can reduce nitrogen leaching by another 6 to 14%. But we can also reduce the amount of water used substantially, anywhere from 17 to about 25%. So we can get water savings as well as reduce nitrogen leaching. When we plant a cover crop, we can reduce nitrogen losses by 25% during the period between harvest of the crop and planting of the next crop. So that's the period when, without a cover crop, the soil would be bare. And we find that we get higher N uptake if the rye, which is the cover crop we're using, is planted after soybeans. So there's something about soybeans. They have a shorter growing season. They're harvested earlier. You can plant the cover crops earlier. They also release nitrogen back to the soil because they fix it from the atmosphere. And this is good for the cover crop. And it appears there's some benefits to rye from the low residue cover after soybeans. So all these factors combine to make rye planted after soybeans really effective at reducing nitrogen. The rye planted after corn is less effective, but if we could plant the rye before the corn is harvested using something like that robot I showed you, which can actually plant rye into a standing corn crop, we can get much better stand establishment. The last thing we were studying is the impact of perennial crops on nitrate losses. So we compared nitrate losses under corn to nitrate losses in the same area with switchgrass, which is used for biofuels, and if you have cellulosic ethanol, or Kernza, which is being widely promoted by General Mills for use in breads and malting. So the results are truly amazing. You can get 83% reduction in nitrogen losses with switchgrass and 99% reduction with Kernza. Now, our precision agriculture research is making a big difference in the state of Minnesota with regards to workforce and job development and with regards to business, agribusiness. We're working with a number of different companies locally to help roll out the adoption of these technologies. We've worked with Soiltech, Farmers Edge, Geosys, and Terra, Centech, Earth Scout, and Aglytics, and also have had contacts with Land O'Lakes and CHS. And we can get quotes from a number of these companies, but one of the companies that we work with said, our relationship with Professors David Muller, Carl Rose, and Fabian Fernandez, and Dan Kaiser has and will continue to have a tangible impact both on technological development and on user applications revolving around our products. This is just the CEO of one of the companies we work with. We leverage funds from federal and state agencies, as well as from our college, from commodity groups, from the state legislature. So there's been a lot of investment in this type of research, which we very much appreciate. We have an active set of faculty who engage in extension and outreach through University of Minnesota Extension. And these are very effective at delivering information about precision agriculture to our user audiences. These programs reach agribusiness professionals who train other farmers. They reach growers, they reach agency personnel, and they reach the public. And we literally reach thousands of people every year. This slide is a bit busy, but it just highlights all the different programs we actually have going on in extension and outreach. We have short courses, we have field schools, we have workshops and conferences. We have a nitrogen smart training program for farmers. We have programs in the Red River Valley, and we have online presence through YouTube, through web pages, through mobile media, and through social media. So we're reaching a lot of people. Ends up being thousands and thousands of people every year. So to conclude, there are many benefits to precision agriculture: increased profitability and reduced crop loss for growers, increased efficiency of inputs through N fertilizer, pesticides, and irrigation, protection of surface and groundwater quality, strong university and industry partnerships, job creation and workforce development, and effective extension and outreach. That concludes my presentation. Here's my contact information and a link to our website. I'd be happy to entertain any questions or comments.
Members, any? Representative Tuckelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Mulla, for your presentation, and thanks to the university and to you for your work in these areas of great importance to the state of Minnesota and to Minnesota agriculture, frankly. The potential, of course, is great. Many of these technologies are being adapted and adopted by farmers all across the state on an ongoing basis. The trend is our friend, I would say, and that's all good news. You talked early in your presentation about organic matter and the nitrogen involved with the conversion of that. And in addition to that, have you incorporated, it seems to me anyway, that there's a lot of legacy nitrogen in our soil profiles as a result of past applications and in some cases past over-application. Have you incorporated that into your analysis of the potential for reduction in nitrogen in ground and surface water?
Honorable Chair and members, yes. Thank you for your question. It's true that the soil supplies a very large amount of the nitrogen that's needed for crop production. It could be anywhere from a half to a third of all the nitrogen that the crop uses. And the remainder has to come from other sources, like fertilizer or manure. And in areas where there is over-application of nitrogen, particularly fields where manure as well as fertilizer are applied, there can be legacy nitrogen. And we're trying to develop better tools to estimate the nitrogen release based on organic matter, because this is a big knowledge gap right now that leads to difficulties in recommending fertilizer. But there is a lot of promise in using crop models that take into account the temperature of the soil and the moisture content of the soil, along with the organic matter content, to predict when and where and how much nitrogen the soil release. And that's an active area of our research right now.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So some of that legacy nitrogen, of course, has been driven down below the root zone and is no longer accessible by the crop, so the crop cannot remove it. And I guess my point is we need to target our work given the situation not only of the crop but of the soil profile.
Honorable Chair and members, thank you. There is a large amount of nitrogen that already has leached below the rooting zone and is on its way to the groundwater. And this is another issue that's something people should be aware of. When we do water quality monitoring by putting a probe down a well or taking samples from a well, that probably reflects the nitrogen that was added anywhere from 5 to 25 years ago. So it doesn't reflect what's going to happen in the next 5 to 25 years. There could be a pulse that's actually heading downward and could be increasing our groundwater pollution.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, you were talking about precision agriculture. Do you have a sense for how many percentage points of the farmers across the state are using precision agriculture in daily operations?
Honorable Chair and members, as I mentioned earlier, the rates of adoption vary depending on what technology is involved. So, for instance, about 80 to 90% of all the Minnesota farmers today use auto steer in some form to avoid overlap when they're spreading fertilizer or spraying herbicides. So this cuts down on the over-application in those overlaps. That's a big advantage. When it comes to yield mapping, again, about 60 to 70% of the farmers are actually mapping the variability in yield, and that can be used to, if you look at it over a long term, to identify where you get your highest productivity, where you get your lowest productivity, and to adjust rates of fertilizer. So it's, again, a good thing to for farmers to use those data. When it comes to variable rate nitrogen, we estimate that about 15 to 20% of Minnesota farmers are using variable rate nitrogen now. So there's a lot of opportunity, particularly with variable rate nitrogen, for increased growth and adoption. And that's what our research is trying to address.
Yes, Representative Brand.
And with everything, of course, it comes down to cost and how things pencil out. Which would you say would be the most costly technology right now for farmers to implement?
I think the most costly technology today is, honestly, it's the auto steer. I mean, some of the units are $15,000 to $30,000. The advantage is it's a one-time cost. Mm-hmm. When you look at a lot of the other costs, for instance, variable rate nitrogen, a farmer can engage a technical service provider and pay anywhere from $5 to $15 an acre for the services of doing that variable rate nitrogen. So that's getting into the range where it's actually pretty cost effective when you look at the overall cost of inputs for a farm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Torkelson?
Just an interjection, Mr. Chair. The equipment may be a one-time cost, but there are ongoing subscription fees to keep that GPS system operating, and they're not cheap either.
Right.
This is none of this comes free. But another question, Dr. Muller, you know, one of the things that producers are concerned about is the privacy of our data. We are collecting a lot of data on what's happening on the ground, happening on our farm, in and on our farm fields, but we as operators have very little control over who has access to that data. Have you got any opinions or?
Honorable Chair and members, yes. I agree, privacy is a huge issue, and it comes up over and over again when farmers are engaging with their service providers. You know, the model for data privacy that is being developed by Google and Facebook and others simply not going to work in agriculture. And farmers realize that their data is valuable, that people and companies are interested in that data. And there are other uses for data in terms of determining, you know, rental prices for land and sale prices for land. So farmers are rightfully concerned about the privacy of these data. And many companies are trying to put in place better policies for handling the data that they are able to provide to their farmers. So it's an issue that a lot of agribusiness companies are wrestling with right now. On the other hand, there are real big advantages if data could be pooled, as long as it can be done anonymously. So as an example, I want to cite the country of Sweden, where they have this model of cooperative farming, and every farmer will do grid sampling of their fields, and then they'll send all the data from that sampling effort to a central repository, and then you know, there will be an analysis of the data to find out what kind of soil types need more fertilizer, what kinds don't, which slopes are more vulnerable, which areas of the country have different kinds of soils that need additional management. And so by pooling data together, it is possible to really make a significant leap forward in terms of understanding how better to manage, you know, farm inputs. But that comes at a trade-off, and in Sweden they've made the trade-off with data. Their data is not private. That's not going to happen here, but there may be some commercial models that companies can develop where they protect the anonymity of the owner of the data and make some kind of use of the large data pools through artificial intelligence to make better recommendations for everybody.
Dr. Mulla, a couple years ago, the legislature passed some legislation at the request of the university to, as they went out to try and do more research concerning analyzing the inputs of the farmers and to what net effect their operation might cause on their surrounding environment. The purpose of the legislation was to protect, it was actually to include the farmers' specific data under the data privacy regulations, and yet, of course, still allow the university in a broad form to share the summary of your findings and that type of thing. Do you work in particular with that element in your studies?
Honorable Chair and members, we are very concerned about protecting the privacy of individual growers. And so, obviously, in a research capacity, we do get access to large data sets. But when we release the data sets to the public, we always make sure that the results are aggregated at a scale where it's not possible to identify individual growers.
Right.
So that's been our general philosophy.
Okay. Any other questions, members? If not, Dr. Mulla, thank you for your presentation. Very interesting. And we, again, appreciate it a great deal.
Thank you.
Chair?
Oh, yes.
I just wanted to also thank Dr. Mulla. He happens to be a neighbor and a constituent.
Thank you, Senator.
Okay.
Sure.
Time for the director's report. Mr. Stark.
Mr. Chair and members, first of all, I want to thank Mr. Larson and Professors Higger and Mulla for their presentations. They were very great, and I think addressed some of the questions that you had and were very targeted. So thank you for that. I've discussed our next meeting with the chairs, and at this point, we're proposing that our next meeting be on October 17th at 9 o'clock in the morning. Now, that date follows the Water Resources Conference, which is at the River Center, and I encourage you to attend that meeting. There are about 800 people that attend that meeting. There are plenary speakers that are right on point with some of the water issues, and if you really want to find out about all of the things that are going on with respect to water in Minnesota, that is the place to be. So that is the 15th and the 16th. Our meeting would follow that the next day. The deadline for registration for the early bird has passed, but I've worked with the organizers of the conference, and you can register right up to the day of the conference at the reduced rate. So some of you have registered. If you'd like to register now for that meeting and then be reimbursed, we can do that with you. But if you want to register, if your schedules are uncertain at this point, want to register at the door, you can still do that. So that is an option. I would certainly encourage you to attend that conference if you can, because it's a really good one. Then, moving on, Mr. Chair, in your packets is a letter, and it's in draft form, and that letter is to leadership of the environmental committees and divisions in the House and the Senate, as well as to the environmental commissions within state government. And that letter would describe the priorities that the subcommittee is working on, and it would ask for the ability to come to those divisions and subcommittees and committee meetings as the session begins to kind of lay that out. So wanted you to be aware of that. We plan to send that out, hearing no objections, and with under the over the signatures of the chairs. So that is our plan. Then I want to say a few words about the field trip. The field trip that some of us went on yesterday was again sponsored by the Clean Water Council. It was in southeastern Minnesota. We focused on several things. We focused on stream restoration. We saw some examples of stream restoration that are being accomplished with monies from the state environmental programs under your direction. We learned a lot about karst geology and groundwater geology in that area of the state. And we looked at some of the best management practices that are occurring and occurring as a result of state programs that promote them across the state. So with that, I just thought we could open this up for a bit, Mr. Chair, and if members who participated want to reflect on that meeting, I think the rest of the membership and the audience here would benefit from that. So let's turn this over to the chair, and if others want to reflect on that, that'd be great.
Well, thank you, Mr. Stark. I would say that probably one of the things that is unique in terms of the area in which we were located in is that as you look at the overall watershed, how it begins in one geological area and ends in another substantially different type of geological area, that being the start of it over in the Grand Meadow area and then going into areas in the Preston area where we were, you know, obviously had substantial examples of the karst geology there and that type of thing. And certainly recognizes that, you know, sometimes we deal with general items up here within the legislature, and yet very seldom can we ever be specific enough to deal with the myriad of individual situations that exist out in our landscape. And I think we always need to keep that in mind, that sometimes we need to be looking for ways to make our state agencies to be able to adapt on the more on their feet and respond to the different situations that they encounter. We just can't carte blanche apply rules because they have certainly different effects in the different areas in which we have represented in the state. Any other members that were there? Representative Heintzman.
I would echo a number of the same comments that you made, Mr. Chair, in that there are a number of us from numerous parts of the state participating in yesterday's field tour. In fact, a reporter asked me if I thought that it was a good use of time to put together something like what we were participating in yesterday. And I said, well, I'm from the Lakes area. I have primarily sand and clay between Crow Wing and Aiken counties, and being in the karst land was just a completely different environment. So I thought there was a benefit for me to be able to understand and see that. So I agree, Mr. Chair, there's definitely differences across the state of Minnesota, and it gave, I think, a lot of us an opportunity to see something we otherwise wouldn't see. And when you're making decisions relative to policy that's going to affect the entire state of Minnesota, it was a benefit. So I thought it was very nice to see some of those differences.
Yeah, Senator Eaton and then Senator Weaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to say I was most fascinated by the project we met with the individual farmer and heard the processes that he was going through with the help of the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, the University. There were a whole different group of people working with him on a lot of the issues that Dr. Muller brought up with he was switching when he fertilized from the fall to the spring, and he was putting in a pollinator strip in the middle of the field, and they were monitoring the nitrogen that was coming out at different parts of the field. Anyway, it made me very hopeful that we have hope that we're going to meet some of these targets that we talk about. I wasn't aware of all these things going on, and I don't think the farmers get enough credit for the work that they are doing to mitigate some of these issues.
Thank you. Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Chair. Yeah, great program. I represent a suburban district, and going down to the southeast corner, and I have been that part of the state before, but getting the excellent presentations, looking at the various aspects of the karst topography, I too, like Senator Eaton, really enjoyed the visit on the farm. Wayne DeWall, I believe, a three-generation farm and 600 some acres, and seeing the corn, the soybeans, and then all the partnerships at local state level, and the pride that's gone into this, into the monitoring, and the windmills around us. That was fun, but it was also fun, Mr. Chair, making a canoe with you. And some of us had a chance to make a canoe. It was a part of the International Water Institute up near Senator Eakin's district, and it's a program geared toward students, many of them in fourth grade, and they have a capsule project where they make a canoe, and then it's launched, and on its journey, actually, they will chart where it might be found, and we can put messages on that canoe, but they tie it in with the education, and we did a good job.
Senator Wieger, I'm sure ours is halfway to the Mississippi River by now. I am confident.
He's Senator, a small canoe.
Yeah.
That was Gugger. My question. Did the canoe actually float that we did?
It floated. Okay. It actually wound up, when it was launched, it wound up in the middle, in the current, and away from the brush, and away it was gone.
Yes, Senator Gugger.
I have to confess that mine started out upside down.
Yeah. As did the representative's canoe, by the way. So. anything else for those that were on the tour would like to comment on? Yeah.
Just want to thank the Clean Water Commission and Mr. Yep. Stark and everybody for putting it together and inviting us.
Yeah, very much. Mr. Gardner from Clean Water and all the Clean Water folks, thank you very much for that opportunity. And, what we really need to do is get some of you city folks out into a hog barn next, then we can give you the full experience. With that, Mr. Stark, is there anything else that you have for us?
Mr. Chair and members, one more thing. So today at 1 o'clock, we have our second and last stakeholder meeting where we focus on legislative issues and initiatives for the upcoming session. We held a meeting in August. At that point, based on input from you and others and things that had, were held over from last session, we had about 26 issues that we discussed in that group. As a result of that meeting, we've narrowed that down to about 15, and we're going to talk about those today. So today we will break up into small groups. We're asking people to self-select the issue, and we're really looking for very pointed and clear and concise objectives for each one of those issues, and that'll be the process today, 1 to about 30. I hope you can attend, members of the gallery as well. So after that, that will be our last stakeholder meeting. After that, we'll have another opportunity for people to comment on specific legislative issues in a different format, electronic format of kind, using Google Docs. So these meetings are a little bit chaotic, but we're going to give people another chance to be more specific and spend more time on the things that are of most interest to them.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Stark. Thank you, folks who are in the gallery, and thank you, members, for being here. If Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, do you need to take any official action for this letter already been sent?
It has not been sent. I think the position was that it would be sent unless we heard any objection from members.
No objection, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. With that, then, we stand adjourned.
Good to go.
Thank you.
I got that sheet. I got it.